You're listening to the 27th episode of the Imran and Akhil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akhil Krishnan.
And I'm Arman Rana. It's the 19th of April, 2025 at 5:12 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamenam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hi, and I'm Isa Yu.
Isa, I think we just missed you, but yeah, so we have a former co-host of Arman's, Isa Yu, a guest hosting with us today. So Arman, tell us about how you know Isa. And
So we used to do a show called Democracy Watch back in the day when we were young and idealistic college students with much to say about the world. And
Sweet summer children.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Isa.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's.
So how have you been? How have you been, Nicole? What's new with you?
I've been good. I've been good. Busy. I know this. I missed the show last time. Thank you for the shout out, by the way. I was out away in India.
Did I say anything bad about you or?
No. Just something about me neglecting my duties.
Okay.
as a host, but I was in India for my sister's wedding, which was a blast. We had a great time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a signature achievement of mine in my life so far. I met a lot of family as you do these events.
That's a very masculine view of the world that you're taking credit for your sister's wedding. what is this?
It was done with my approval.
Yeah. You arranged the wedding. You found the groom, and
the groom had to ask for your
permission. you challenged him to a personal 1v1 before.
Yeah, just to be clear, that did not happen. But it was fun, and I'm happy to be back, and I'm happy to be back now, especially that there are some things that are going on which are interesting. Some would say.
Yeah. Is there an election going on?
There is. I've heard there's an election going on. Which one?
There's an election, Canadian. It's a federal one, right?
Oh, federal. Yeah. Wow, sounds important. So let's jump straight in. So there's a federal election going on. We are in the writ period right now, so the election is in full swing. Advanced voting just started yesterday.
You voted, right?
I haven't voted yet.
Oh my gosh.
I did drive by a polling station and I remarked at how much participation there seemed to be because there was a very long line out the door and I said, not today. But I will be back tomorrow.
Okay.
So but you voted.
I voted first thing on advanced polling and very long queues of elderly ladies.
How many polling stations do you think UBC has?
Just one advanced polling. Crazy, like just in the golf course for the entirety. But I guess for the students, there's something else going on in the nest.
Hmm.
So they had like advanced polling in the nest from the 13th.
Hmm.
For actual advanced polling for residents of the area, there's only one.
All right, so there's a federal election. One of us has voted, the other has not. Isa, have you voted?
I have. I voted this morning. I was in line for...
Yeah, you were texting me while
we were having a conversation about this.
So I'm the least keen to vote out of all the three of us in the studio, apparently.
Yeah.
So the federal election going on. What are we going to be talking about today?
Yeah. So maybe let's... we've got the federal election. We've got Liberation Day, south of the border. And we've got some, local news. There was a local by-election here, which had an interesting result. So those are the major themes. I think to kick things off, we probably just... you just play out. We've got like three different clips. This is the RIP period, so we're not going to give too many hot takes about the candidates, just to be more balanced in our coverage. But we'll just play three clips and give some analysis about where the election is right now.
All right, let's listen first to the current Prime Minister, Mark Carney.
Mr. Poilievre, you spent years running against Justin Trudeau and the carbon tax, and neither—they're both gone. Okay, they're both gone. Look, I'm a very different person from Justin Trudeau. Focus is on results.
Were you his economic advisor?
And so, how to drive results in the housing market? You've got to change the model of building. You've got to increase the financing for housing developers, $25 billion on the table for those housing developers, $10 billion for deeply affordable homes. Maybe difficult.
So that was the Prime Minister Mark Carney. We're going to now go to we'll play the clips on our trot.
Yeah.
We will repeal the federal plastics ban, including the ban on plastic straws, checkout bags, food containers, and cutlery, because consumers and businesses should be free to choose what works best for them. We will eliminate labeling and packaging requirements that raise the cost of fresh produce and groceries by up to 34%, because families shouldn't have to pay more to eat healthy. We will protect restaurants, grocers, and low-income Canadians from costly, one-size-fits-all packaging rules that hit the people who can least afford it, causing them to pay the most.
If you're looking for something that's really a talker for ordinary people, I think this...
Yeah, so that was Polyev on affordability and his plan to bring back single-use plastics. And now Jagmeet Singh on crime.
And Mr. Polyev get away with making this ludicrous claim that anyone on this stage thinks that violent crime should get a less severe penalty. Obviously, that is not a special position that he's taking. Everyone agrees that horrible crimes should have horrible sentences. Judges are equipped to do that. So don't let Mr. Polyev's rhetoric confuse people. Obviously, everyone agrees that if someone does something horrible, they should pay a horrible price for it. There should be appropriate sentence that's put in place by a judge. But what I'm concerned about is all of what Mr. Polyev is talking about is after the fact. Now, there's heinous things that happen, and there needs to be severe penalties put in place. But we also need to keep communities safe. And that's what my focus is. Well, how do we stop crime before it happens? Much of the violent crime that's committed is committed by illegal handguns and firearms that come across the border. Now, Mr. Polyev has admitted that as well, that it is illegal handguns and illegal weapons that are used in violent crime. Let's not let...
So that was the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, on crime. And I believe we have one more.
The last one's about, you know, some younger. What is your kind of analysis of how the campaign's gone so far? What the different, you know, candidates need to do in the last week ahead of the election?
Yeah, I think the campaign's been, it was interesting from the get-go because of just the current climate and just the trend that's unusual. Seeing a party that has a commanding lead see that reversed, historically quite unusual, but once you get into the writ period when you can actually have campaigning is when you see the polls either tighten or they widen based on messaging and preparation. What makes this particularly interesting is just the influences externally on the election, which caused the polling to flip. For context, leading into say January, the polling suggests that there were a significant, maybe not January, but
yeah, to 20-point lead.
Yeah, 20-point lead that the
for the conservatives for, and it had been a lead for like the last time we had like a liberal lead was like 2-3 years.
Yeah, but I think it was mid to early 2023 when there was any sort of neck and neck polling, yeah. And as you've gotten closer and closer to the election, you had former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau resign, Mark Carney win the leadership race, and then the carbon tax being done away. All like signature policy that were signature happenings, like the carbon tax was a huge talking point in this campaign. So it's interesting. What are your thoughts?
Yeah,
I'm just being very mindful of the fact that there needs to be certain regulations.
Yeah, I think for Polyev, I think what he's trying to do is he was embracing some of the the more kind of right-wing populist approach, which some have compared to Trump, and he's trying to kind of maybe tone that down and appear more vanilla politician and more reliable and less of a populist or somebody who's out of the ordinary but still promising change. So that's kind of like the balance, because if he goes too kind of mainstream, he will lose some of those people on his right wing flank, right? And for Carney, I think his challenge is, a month ago, Trump was in the news all the time talking about annexing Canada. And that's not happening anymore. Trump has moved on to a Liberation Day and, taking on the whole world. And even though he's being very disruptive, as we'll talk about later, it doesn't center Canada and doesn't, you know, bring about that visceral reaction the same way. Like, there was a poll done which found that, you know, right now, let's say the polling average is, let's say, you know, 38 or 39-44 for the Liberals. If they asked the voters if Trump was replaced by a moderate U.S. president who doesn't want to annex Canada, put tariffs on Canada, who would you vote for? Carney slips to like 37, 1 point behind Poilievre, and the NDP pick up to like 14-15% of the vote, where they're now at 8%, right? So the more Trump recedes and, you know, the conversation shifts back to the issues that were bothering people for a while, that's kind of challenging, you know, to Carney. And then I think Jagmeet Singh, you know, as we saw in the debate, which we played a few clips from, you know, he's really just trying to remain relevant in this conversation and draw attention to himself that he exists and, you know, kind of hold on to some of those, you know, writings.
Absolutely. And the you know, I think a problem for the Conservatives as well is leading up to this campaign, they've been very, their campaign is, the strategy has been to also attack the NDP because of their supply and confidence agreement with the previous government, which I think is coming to bite them a little bit because they've contributed significantly to the NDP probably falling back at least a few percentage points. And in order
driven
for
up
them,
Jagmeet's negatives big time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And like sellout saying and all that stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. And in order for them to have a strong showing, they really do need to have a stronger NDP to taking some of those Liberal votes away. And it's just not what's happening because the winds have completely shifted and the environment's different now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the strategy worked very well when Trudeau was around, and it's shifted considerably since then.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll have to see. Like, the one thing is that anecdotally and also in the polls, like, Conservatives have improved their vote share with South Asians and certain minorities, and so their vote efficiency might be a bit better than we usually expect. So, and on the flip side, Carney's doing well with older white voters, which might worsen the vote efficiency in some ways for Carney. So that's the other thing that, you know, basically Poilievre's path to victory now is, yes, he needs to bring back the polling lead with Carney, which is maybe 4 or 5 points right now on average, but he also needs those minority voters in urban areas and in the suburbs to really shift. And, you know, we saw some of that in the provincial election here, but you need to see that on a wider scale in order, you know, to really, it, you know, it's not enough just to get, you know, 1 or 2% above the Liberals. You really need to win, you know, in the suburbs, both in BC and in Ontario.
Absolutely. One thing that's particularly interesting, even before this whole Trump thing happened, was just the amount of support that Poilievre had from young voters, which is not something traditionally that you see. Well, this young voters shifting to the Conservatives, not something you traditionally see happening. You don't traditionally see like a sandwiching of Liberal voters in the 30 to 55 range with Conservative voters younger than that and Conservative voters older than that?
Yeah, well, actually, I think what we're seeing is like the most, the surveys I've seen, the Liberals are doing the best right now with, you know, 55 plus. They're doing worst with like, you know, maybe 35 to 55 range, and second worst with younger voters, right? So it's not even sandwiching. It's just like...
No, but it was sandwiched
before,
It was sandwiched before. And then now, like as you said, it's shifted.
Yeah. But yeah, the younger voters, you rarely see them supporting, you know, Conservative candidates. Especially in Canada, just because of social issues, right? But we have seen this in other parts of the world. Like, you know, already this trend was picking up in parts of Europe. And we saw that to some degree recently in the United States with Donald Trump's victory.
And there was also a gender split in the support, particularly among young voters, young male voters supporting more conservative candidates and young women supporting more liberal candidates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's actually hurting the the liberals both ways, because they're losing young men to the conservatives, and they're losing young women to maybe the NDP or the Greens. And that's why they're having particular trouble with younger voters in this election.
So we have a clip about young voters here and what concern is top of mind for them. Do you want to set this one up?
Yeah, I think that's fine. It's a
self-explanatory.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a listen.
As millions of young voters prepare to cast their ballots for the first time, there's a sense of excitement and anticipation leading up to the federal election.
I absolutely plan on voting. I got my election day plans all good to go. I'm excited to be back in my original riding for that, so that'll be helpful.
I started actively watching the news for the first time. So I was watching, I tried to watch both the liberal ones and the conservative ones.
I'm registered to vote. I got a mail-in ballot, so I'll be sending that in.
According to a recent Léger survey of young voters, Mark Carney's liberals have a slight edge in the polls over Pierre Poilievre and the conservatives. The study also highlighted affordability as the number one issue with first-time voters, which was echoed by many UBC students.
I find that, you know, when you look at the rental prices, grocery prices, it's like really, really expensive. It's really hard to imagine being able to support yourself without having to live with like four or five other people sometimes.
Vancouver, it's very unaffordable. It's hard to find a place. It's hard to afford a place.
I'm only 18 years old, first time voting in a federal election. Home ownership is huge to me. Housing plans are huge to me.
While the turnout for young voters has been down in recent federal elections, the students I spoke with say that this has been a major topic of conversation with their peers.
Considering this is probably a lot of our first times voting, especially just because of the age group. So yeah, I think everyone I've spoken to has had full intentions and really passionate about this election. Everybody I've run into has had the election on their mind. We've been talking about it. And I do think that this election will be an important one for Canada, especially considering our current trade relations.
Earlier this week, post-secondary campuses had held advanced voting stations that saw thousands of students take to the polls early. According to Elections Canada, over 12,000 students in BC cast their ballot, with over 75,000 across the country over the course of 3 days. While political views and issues can change for many voters come election night.
So that's interesting. But young voters are going to be a huge factor in this election.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, when you actually look at the data, like, very few young people actually vote. Politically, having the 55-plus age category is just worth so much more than younger voters in a general election. Maybe this is like the one in 20-year election where young voters matter. That happens like once in 20 years where young voters really turn out. But in general, they don't really turn out in the numbers that they could. And they don't, you know, really alter the outcomes of elections. It's kind of depressing.
But do you think any candidate has produced a vision of a path forward that is inspiring in how it would potentially bring down, like, you know, improve affordability for housing, like improve access, basically, right?
I think actually that's something Pierre Poilievre is really good at, right? The vision of, like, he keeps describing this, like, affordable house on safe streets with your family. And that's like one of his, you know, talking points. The steps to get to that destination, you know, that's a very difficult path, and different policies have put forward policies to do that. But I think that's been actually very central to his campaign. And part of the reason why he's been successful with young people is because he keeps emphasizing that, you know, that vision of his, and kind of makes it, you know, kind of, you know, asks the uncomfortable questions that about, like, why aren't we there as a society? Even though, you know, some people might say the solutions to that are not necessarily that he puts forward are not necessarily the right direction, but he has been targeting that demographic.
Because when I think about young people voting, and generally about any kind of voting group that's apathetic, what you want is some sort of is like a really charismatic candidate who's putting forth this really grand vision that appeals to the naivete of young people.
What I found
in
very interesting was that 18-year-old guy, and he said home ownership is really important to him. I found that very interesting because, you know, I wasn't thinking about home ownership when I was 18. Like, it was not something that was top of mind for me when I was voting and stuff. So
So you were just a wide-eyed idealistic.
Not wide-eyed.
Change the world.
Not wide-eyed idealistic, but you're just like, I'm more focused on what's immediately in front of you the next two, three years, right? Like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to college, you know, get a good job, maybe earn some money. Like, there are like so many steps down the road. Like housing prices today and what housing prices will be there when I graduate college, if, you know, 5-6 years down the line. You know, it's so different. So I wasn't even looking at what housing prices were when I was 18. Like, why would I do that? How much does it cost to buy a house when I'm 18? Like,
but I think that might be part of the problem is that housing prices are going to be so different when I graduate.
Yeah, right. That's why, like, I don't know. I do find that interesting that I think that's part of that vision is that, like, it's not just, yes, there are affordability constraints on young people, but Pierre Polyev has been very effective at, you know, giving some young people a vision, a path, a very traditional one, but being like saying, this is what you should be aspiring towards, even if you're 18 or 16 or 19 or whatever, this is what you should be focused on in life, rather than other things, right?
For sure. One final thought I have about that is when you have such a large conversation about that, about one thing, say in this case housing, I think you hear so much about how this generation and every generation after is never going to be able to afford a house. That's probably contributing to it, right? The younger and younger people are thinking about the fact that it's not like a transient thing, like, oh, the cost of eggs in the United States is expensive now, but obviously we can just, like, you know, get more birds, that the price could come down. And it's more transient as opposed to people saying, well, you will never, are you under 20 years of age? You will never afford a house. Did you think that that's got to play a role into why younger people thinking about
it? I think
it,
that was the case, especially in Vancouver. That Vancouver's had housing problems forever, right? It's always been a place in Canada and a place in the world where wealthy people park their money in real estate. You know, when the NDP came to power, they came to power partially on a housing agenda, right? Mm-hmm. On housing affordability, on, you know, they introduced speculation tax and you know, different sorts of ways to vacancy tax to prevent people buying up houses and keeping them empty, right? So, and they increased taxes on, you know, high expensive houses. So I think housing has always been an issue for those who looked into it. And on the flip side, if you look historically, Canada has had kind of housing bubbles in the past, right? It's, if you go back 50 years, you know, there was a period of time where housing went up like crazy for, you know, 20, 30 years. And then it kind of plateaued for a couple of decades. And honestly, I think there's a good chance that housing costs, because they haven't kept up with incomes, they've become so out of whack, and now there are all these restrictions on foreign ownership, there's a very good chance that housing costs do plateau to some degree over the next couple of decades because people just can't afford them, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, Carney's put forth this plan to spend like $30 billion building, like the government actually going into the business of building housing, which is kind of, you know, crazy for the so-called centrist.
Yeah. crazy in the Canadian context because it's in recent memory has basically not been done, right?
Yeah,
any kind of large scale effort in that way by the federal government.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, we'll see what happens. Maybe that young man will be proven right to be so concerned about housing in, you know, 5 years down the line.
Maybe he will one day buy a house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's planning.
You wouldn't say that confidently.
He's saving up now.
Well, if he just skips that latte
and the avocado toast, do Zoomers still eat avocado toast?
Our in-house Zoomer expert.
I can contribute. I feel like yes, but people make it at home now. I also do think I'm thinking from the young voters' perspective. I wonder if like specifically on housing, like having the perspective of our parents and being in conversation of like our parents' generations and like the current generation and the ways like home, the feasibility of home ownership has changed so much. Like, I wonder if that knowledge is also part of why, like, young voters are like interested in this as a topic. Also, like, if you're feeling that you can't afford groceries, then like fixating, actually, I don't know where I'm going with this point, but like fixating on this broader fantasy of like a white picket fence could also be like another way of like not, because like you are relatively powerless when you come to like, when it comes to grocery prices and like very materially feeling inflation. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the use of the word fantasy when you described home ownership, the prospect of home ownership is correct.
It's like, it's a fantasy with, not with dragons or like with unicorns.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy to have a house with a white picket fence. What a creative fantasy.
I mean, but that's the reality we live in these days. Yeah. So it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but that's what makes it so powerful, an image, right? That, yeah. that is a it is a fantasy. It is, yeah.
That's why it's compelling, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So a lot of things are obviously contributing to the upward pressure in prices and inflation, which obviously has come down in recent months from the COVID post COVID high. Like, not exactly post COVID, but just as COVID was still in its kind of winding down phase, let's say. So one of the major pressures recently has been the volatility in trade policy from the United States, as we're all aware. You know, the tariffs that Trump announced 2 months ago on Canada, Mexico.
Liberation Day.
Which preceded by tariffs that were announced on Mexico and Canada, which were then put on hold for a month, and then they were turned on again almost, but then they were put on hold again.
Oh, yeah, you're before liberation.
Exactly. So, and then
you were in the oppressed stages, the oppression period.
In the alpha stage where you're just like working on it behind closed doors and it's not ready for public consumption.
It's like the initial uprisings, the skirmishes before Liberation Day.
Exactly. Which brought us to Liberation Day.
Yeah.
So tell us from your perspective, Armand, how did you feel about Liberation Day?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, we are in Canada, so we don't get to experience the liberation. But I think a lot of Americans will soon be experiencing the liberation from, you know,
able to afford foreign-made goods.
Many goods. Even those, you know, already there's affordability crisis. So, and there'll just be shortages. I was speaking, so, you know, I worked for a U.S.-based company. A bunch of my colleagues had driven up across the border for a team event. And I was speaking to my former manager, and she was telling me already in U.S. stores, they've started having, when you go to the shopping mall, it says a lot of the shelves are empty. And in the clothing stores, it often says max one item per customer. So it's pretty much like entering, like, this is not, you know, this is a single anecdote, but the fact that this is happening at all, you know, it's so ironic because it just reminds me of, like, you know, how people used to mock like Soviet Russia back in the day.
The bread lines, yeah.
Yeah, this is like bread lines. At least in the Soviet Russia, like the bread was subsidized,
yeah.
Right? Like, this is like you have to queue up in a bread line and then you have to pay overpriced bread. And you only get one.
Yeah.
And it's like the government has added extra taxes on it.
Exactly.
Just for good measure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because it's not, you know, I think when people think about tariffs, they're thinking, oh, okay, things will become more expensive. It's also going to cause shortages, right? Because, first of all, like, all these people are hoarding inventory. Even consumers are hoarding inventory. But companies are also hoarding inventory to insulate themselves from tariffs. And then on the flip side, you know, and maybe we can transition to that topic. You know, there was the, you know, various like DHL and various other businesses are just like eliminating certain aspects of their business and trade with the U.S. to just avoid having to deal with this kind of, you know, nonsense and confusion around the tariffs.
Yeah, just before you do, just to take your point forward, right? There's a certain amount you can do in terms of what the demand is, right? The demand is that you make stuff in the United States in order to avoid these tariffs. there's this idea that you will move manufacturing or whatever into the U.S. or just find a supplier in the U.S. who's willing to do that. But the question comes down to how quickly can you do that? Because when you're talking about this, on one side, you're talking about the money in terms of revenue or how much money you spend, whether it's cheaper coming from abroad or it's more expensive. But the on the other side of that question is real stuff that needs to get made. That's the side of the equation that's the hardest to deal with, that you can't just say, well, move it here. Like, what's the problem? Why don't you just set up a couple other factories, right? And to now move to this, what ends up happening is that you now have an additional tax on goods coming from abroad, which is effectively a federal sales tax. And then companies bringing it in don't have the infrastructure to deal with all of the additional paperwork that comes with the new regulations.
Yeah, well, what was the last time, I'm trying to remember, when somebody tried to impose taxes on foreign goods across the border in the United States, before it was the United States. I think there was something happened around the time. There was a bit of a party, right?
A tea party. Yes, there were some people who were very angry about their chai tea lattes that were costing a little too much at the matcha bar, and they had something to say about that. Was that the year 17?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a fundamental, like, the USA doesn't have even a sales tax at the federal level, right?
No, they don't. And this is effectively a federal sales tax that is basically not trade blind, right? Like, our GST is a federal sales tax that is trade blind. It doesn't matter where the good comes from. You have to pay a GST on it. Their sales tax is not trade blind, but it indirectly bleeds into everything that you, almost everything that you have, because almost nothing in the global economy comes from a single country. No processed product likely comes from a single economy.
So thankfully, you are, you know, gainfully employed in this industry, so you can provide us more insight. But I just want to kick off, you know, this by reading out a statement by DHL. Important update regarding shipments to the United States with a customs value exceeding USD 800. And it says, as a result of U.S. customs regulatory updates, we are experiencing multi-day transit delays to the United States from any origin for shipments with a declared customs value exceeding US$800. Effective Monday, April 21st, and until further notice, we will be temporarily suspend the collection and shipping of business-to-consumer shipments to private individuals in the United States where the declared customs value exceeds US$800. Shipments with a declared value below 800 are not affected by suspension. Business-to-business shipments to U.S. companies are not impacted, though they may also face delays. What else? It also says this change has caused a surge in formal customer clearances, which we are handling around the clock. While we are U.S. All shipments with a U.S. declared value over $800 require formal entry process, down from the previous $2,500 threshold. So in addition to the tariffs, they've also reduced, I presume, the personal exclusion amount? But yeah, can you just give us more insight into why, you know, why do you think this is happening and what burden this is putting on shipping companies, you know, these new tariffs?
For sure. So just a few terms to define. One is that $800 limit is called the de minimis value. That just means that anything under that is duty-free. And it doesn't matter where the origin is. There are some certain exclusions to that, like, for instance, alcohol, et cetera. So you can only, you know, if you go into the United States, we have these rules. They have them as well. So if you go into the United States for under 24 hours, you can't turn around and bring back alcohol. There's no personal exemption for that. But broadly, $800 is the value that you can, up to which you can import a good without paying a tax on it, without paying a tariff on it. The other thing is, what is formal clearance? There's basically a few tiers of customs clearance. For goods that are previously under $2,500, now under $800, there was a process called informal clearance, where you basically didn't need a customs broker. The goods could come in, go directly to the customer, come in as a business, whatever, unless they were like a regulated commodity, alcohol, textiles, to give you two examples. You could do that without a customs broker. It was very quick and relatively inexpensive, even the processing. Now, that they've introduced like a whole package of changes, but that's the biggest one for now. Everything over $800 requires formal clearance, which means you need a customs broker. You need to put up a customs bond, which is you either put up the money itself as financial security in order for your goods to be released, because the CBSA does, the CBP, sorry, doesn't know if you're actually going to pay the duties. If you want to, basically, if you're a business importing 100 shipments a year, they don't know that you're going to pay the duty on every single one of them before they it's delivered to you. So what they expect you to do is they you set up what's called a continuous bond. So it's financial security, right? So there's all of these requirements. It's just to illustrate the fact that it's very complicated. And the biggest part of this is you need a customs broker to submit all of this paperwork, which means you need a human being to sit there and actually process this.
Yeah, and can you just also give us an example? Like you were talking about, you know, how right now there isn't a way to break down, if you, you know, the steel and aluminum tariffs, there isn't a way to break down by percentage. And is that also true for country of origin if you have, you know, percentage from different countries? So how are right now those tariffs being applied when, let's say, a good is partially, you know, has a small piece of it that's made out of steel or aluminum, or has a small piece of it that's made in China? How are the tariffs right now being applied?
For sure. So you, the document that kind of accompanies any shipment is called a commercial invoice, and that's supposed to have all of the information of what is in the shipment, and you can provide as much detail as possible, right? You can break it out into 100 line items if you want to, with each one, like each part of that having details about where it was made, what the value is, et cetera. The problem is twofold. One is in terms of just capacity to process, which this industry does not have the capacity to process that many shipments that they were talking about. The other thing is just the technical ability in this industry to be that granular, which has never been required before. So suddenly when you slap this on, you're going to see a number of these shipments that whether this capacity didn't exist before, suddenly having to exist for basically 30 years now since NAFTA was signed. Both the Canada and Mexico trading with the US have not had to submit most types of like granular paperwork for any of this because everything was duty-free.
Yeah. But take an example, like if we're like...
So to take an example, right? If you had to import, say if you were in Canada and you were exporting, say an umbrella,
yeah,
right, into the United States, the umbrella has obviously textiles, but it also has aluminium and has steel. Now, and say that the umbrella was made in China. Now, when it's exported to the U.S., let's assume this umbrella, like these, there's 100 umbrellas you're shipping. Each of them is $10, so it's a $1,000 shipment. It's going into the United States. Now, it's going to get hit first because it's from China with the 145% tariff.
Yeah.
All right? That's $1,450 just on the China tariff. And then it's going to get the 25% aluminum tariff because it has aluminum in it.
But it's on the total amount of the umbrella, not the value of the aluminum in it.
Yeah, so you could break it down by the amount of aluminum in it, but it's a hit or miss whether or not the entire shipment will get hit with that tariff.
Okay.
Because that level of granularity may or may not exist depending on the customs broker that you choose.
Okay, okay.
So, and so the executive order that he signed basically said that, well, yeah, there's going to be reporting requirements that if you meet those reporting requirements, then we'll consider how much aluminium is in it, and then we'll tariff you based on that. But CBP will have to prescribe these rules. And unlike the way the White House is doing these executive orders, the CBP has to take time in actually developing these rules because they obviously don't want to do it. Like,
so until the time they develop these rules, they're just... And often
it's getting
just
applied on
the whole value.
Exactly.
So even
unless again, right? You are a very large multinational corporation that has a dedicated customs broker that's working on this and that has the capacity to work on a granular level with each and every single one of your shipments. Yeah, it's getting hit on the whole value. So that umbrella example, right? So you'd get $1,450 because of the China tariff, then there would be $250 because of the aluminium, and then $100 to 10% because of the steel. So you would end up basically paying an $1,800 US dollar tariff on a $1,000 shipment, yeah, going into the United States. And suddenly you realize why no US manufacturer is going to want to buy from China. And on the other hand, you have to wonder whether there's actually any meaningful capacity to produce all of these things in the US, which there isn't.
Yeah, and the other example you mentioned was even if, like, let's say the steel or aluminum were from the US, you took them to, let's say, Canada, and you re-exported them to the US, you'd still be hit with the tariff. Is that right?
That's right. And that's that one's particularly interesting because again, the executive order says that there will be reporting requirements of like what kind of documentation you can submit to prove that the aluminum was smelted in the United States, the steel was poured in the United States, and that would exempt you from having to pay that tariff. But right now, there's no guidance on exactly what that documentation looks like. So now, like, is that a sales invoice? Does it have to be a notarized copy from the company? There's no guarantee. So the people in the industry don't know.
Okay, interesting. So let's move on to
our favorite vice president.
So he's had a lot to say about these China tariffs and explaining why he's basically liberating his people. So let's listen to from their affordable goods.
All right, let's take a listen to J.D. Vance.
From Chinese peasants to buy the things those Chinese peasants manufacture.
Vice President Vance, I am a Chinese peasant. Do you realize that your tariff policy will lead to the soaring price of your aluminum?
Okay, so that was a clip of J.D. Vance together with memes that various people in China are putting out to kind of push back on being called peasants by the U.S. vice president.
Exactly. And there's a second response to the J.D. Vance thing there from Xia Baolong, the director of Hong Kong and Macau Affairs, which I thought was really interesting. So let's take a listen to that.
The top Beijing official overseeing SAR affairs has slammed the United States for imposing heavy tariffs on Hong Kong, calling the move extremely arrogant and shameless. Xia Baolong, the director of the Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office, said the U.S. tariffs of up to 145% on SAR goods showed, in his words, that the U.S. is after our very survival. Kelly Yu has this report.
In a video address at the opening ceremony held at the Convention and Exhibition Center to mark National Security Education Day, Xia Baolong said the U.S. levies were particularly unreasonable as Hong Kong is a free port with no tariffs.
This makes it clearer to the world that the U.S. cannot tolerate Hong Kong's prosperity and stability, and it is the biggest sinister manipulator, undermining human rights, freedom, the rule of law, prosperity, and stability in Hong Kong. The U.S. isn't after our tariffs. It is after our very survival.
Mr. Xia said U.S. actions against Hong Kong will ultimately backfire.
Washington's repeated attempts to suppress Hong Kong will only accelerate the demise of its proxies in Hong Kong, which will ultimately backfire on itself. Let those American peasants wail before the 5,000-year-old civilization of the Chinese nation.
So, the Chinese peasants are going to wail.
The American peasants
are going to wail. Sorry, the American peasants are going to wail.
You're going to get cancelled on Chinese social media now.
That was a Freudian slip out of the first one. I do not wear eyeliner. Please don't at me. This is just another illustration of just how much... This particular incident was very interesting because that clip of J.D. Vance saying what he said was basically put on Chinese social media with no censorship, and then they just let users run with it, which is not something you see happen very often, but it was interesting nonetheless. So we are coming to the end of the show, so I want to quickly go through this. Do you want to set up this the fight that the Trump administration is having with the Federal Reserve in the United States?
Yeah, so... the prices are going to start soaring, inflation is going to go up. Jerome Powell, who's the head of the Federal Reserve, whose responsibility is to ensure low inflation, low unemployment. And he came out with a statement that, tariffs are going to increase inflation, so interest rates are going to have to remain high. And Trump wasn't super hyped about this concept. Here's what he had to say about his ability to terminate, as he said, Chairman Powell.
Mr. President, on Jerome Powell, you said that the termination of Jerome Powell cannot come fast enough. He says he won't leave even if you ask him to. Do you believe you have...
If I ask him to, he'll be out of there.
Do you believe you have the power to remove him, and are you trying to do that?
I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late, a little slow, and I'm not happy with him. I let him know it, and if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Yeah, so it is a question that will probably go to the Supreme Court, whether he has the ability, if he goes on this path to fire the head of the Federal Reserve. However, regardless of his legal ability to do so, just generally, it's not necessarily a very good sign for – it's a very kind of populist, authoritarian move to fire the head of the Federal Reserve. Especially when it comes to interest rates, we saw that with Erdogan when he kept rotating people, out of that position, it was actually there's something called the coin affair. If people want to look up the history books in Canada, where Diefenbaker attempted to fire his chairman of the Federal Reserve, and that subsequent to that, a lot of measures were put in place to prevent the prime minister from taking such an action. Because it basically weakens the confidence of investors and people who own the debt of your country, that you're not going to inflate away their debt or do any other sort of manipulation to prevent yourself from paying that debt in full.
Yeah. Which is one of the biggest reasons that he wants those interest rates to be cut, is to be able to refinance at a lower interest rate.
That's what's happening. Let's quickly play, do we have time to play Lucy Maloney, the recent victor of the city council election?
I think we do. We'll quickly jump into this. So we're going to close off on local politics. Lucy Maloney, who recently won the one of the two seats in the by-election city council in Vancouver, speaking here.
I think it's muted.
I think that ABC have lost touch with what ordinary Vancouverites are concerned about. I think also Vancouverites are concerned that a lot of the decisions and actions and priorities of this government are out of step with what really needs to be done. We heard on the doors people deeply concerned about losing their housing, about how to pay for their housing, about services and infrastructure looking tired and getting cut back. Also just the sense that the fear that things aren't being done for the right reasons, the integrity commissioner, the park board, all of these things, people were telling us on the doors that they were concerned and unhappy about, feeling that decisions weren't being made for the right reasons.
Yeah. I think if you're have a majority in the city council and then you come like, get like 4%, or like you come like a very distant sixth place,
pretty much dead last.
In this election, pretty much lost touch with the average Vancouverite.
That brings us to the end of the show. Few other things to wrap up. You can find us at the Urmana Kill on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. The music for the show is composed with the inexorable musical talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed.
We do have awesome shows and guests lined up for you to continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our podcasts, as mentioned, on our podcast feed, so do check them out. Thanks again to Isa for joining us, and hopefully you'll be helping us more and contributing more in the shows to come.
Thanks for having me.